out of 300 total votes. 85 reject and 3 are invalid.
Yoon Suk-yeol remains in office, but his presidential powers have been suspended. His future now rests in the hands of the South Korean Constitutional Court, which will decide whether he should be removed as president. The court will hold its first public hearing December 27th. We go now to Seoul, where we're joined by Dae Han-song, head of the networking team of the International Strategy Center, also part of the No Cold War Collective. Can you talk about these latest developments over the weekend?
Sure. This Saturday, basically, there was a vote again in the National Assembly. It hadn't passed the previous Saturday. And in this instance, as you mentioned, 12 of the ruling party members flipped to the side of voting for the impeachment. And I think one of the key moments this week was that Yoon had made a speech in which he basically said, I was completely justified in declaring martial law, and I'm going to fight this to the end, right? Before, the ruling party had been kind of selling this notion of a kind of like an orderly resignation. But basically, the speech kind of completely dispelled the possibility of that. And of course, that switched to flipping. It flipped the key number of his own party members to vote in favor of the impeachment motion. And this also just brought a lot of people this Saturday. If there were like a million people the previous Saturday, there were definitely over a million people. I myself was there about a half mile from the main stage. And even there, it was completely packed, right? And of course, we had people from, I think the speech just even brought even more people, people of all ages, anything from older people, middle-aged people, all the way to just like young people with K-pop light sticks that had come. So yeah, it's very interesting. I was out in talking to some activists and organizers, and one person had mentioned that a lot of people think that this is kind of the understanding of how Yoon could be this way. And people say, oh, Yoon is addicted to alcohol, he's addicted to power, and he's addicted to YouTube, right? And then the question is, addicted to YouTube? Well, I think the idea is that he is not watching the media. He is not, it just speaks to how out of touch he is with what people are thinking, and that he's mostly, you know, the idea is that he's focused mostly on the right-wing, ultra-right-wing media and all that stuff that is feeding a lot of his different talking points, right? So I think that's just to show that how out of touch he is and how his speech reflected that.
Well, what happens next? This has to the vote has to now be reviewed by the Constitutional Court, but there's a problem in terms of the composition of the court. Could you talk about that as well?
Sure. Right now, basically, by the Constitution, there has to be a quorum of seven justices in the Constitutional Court, and then six have to vote for it. Right now, there are only six judges, six justices. And so three of them have to be basically elected, the candidates have to be put forth by the National Assembly, and they have to be approved by the president, which in this case would be the prime minister. A lot of this is procedural. A lot of this stuff has to happen, right? The Constitutional Court, they have to have the number of justices necessary, and also they have to vote to confirm the impeachment. And in some regards, people are assuming that this will happen. But of course, people still need to be on guard, and there still needs to be a lot of eyes from around the world keeping pressure on to make sure that this process continues.
And your concern about the rise of authoritarianism in the world and how South Korea fits into that picture right now, when you clearly have a people's movement that responded to the declaration of martial law and within 6 hours forced the president to take it back.
Sure. I think in many regards, Korean democracy, it's not going to go. It's unwilling to be pushed back to the period of the dictatorship. It's willing to go back to when martial law is declared for no reason other than just to basically maintain your own power. I think what's interesting is that, of course, this is not the first time that it happened, right? 2016, there was also a process that impeached President Park Geun-hye for similar charges. And I think one of the a lot of the conversation that's happening among progressive movements and social movements right now is this idea that if Yoon gets impeached, right, after that, what happens, right? What is the process that follows that? And of course, in the last candlelight protest that impeached President Park Geun-hye, a lot of the reforms, the democratic reforms, a lot of these things that were supposed to happen didn't happen. And that's why 8 years later, now we see history repeating itself. So I think a lot of the conversation right now is about beyond defending democracy, how do you go into expanding democracy by carrying out a lot of different reforms that are necessary in Korea?
Jaehyun Song, I want to thank you for being with us, head of the networking team of the International Strategy Center, part of the No Cold War Collective, speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea. Coming up, we look at the anger unleashed against the health insurance industry following the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, Brian Thompson. Stay with us.
There's an office with a desk with a person and a chair, and you paid for all of it, though you may be unaware. You're paying for the paper, you're paying for the phone, you paid their salary to deny you what you're owed. There ain't no you in United Health, there ain't no me in the company, there ain't no us in the private trust. There's hardly humans in humanity. The procedure that you need ain't the cost-effective route, and only 2% of people end up winning a dispute. So if you get sick, pray to God for help, 'cause all your doctor's prayers go up through UnitedHealth. Way back in 77, Mr. Richard T. Burke started buying HMOs and putting federal grants to work. Now it's $50 million he made just last year, the Warren Buffett of health, the Jeff Bezos of fear.
United Health, Jesse Wells. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to look more at Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, as he walked to a shareholders conference in New York City on December 4th. Mangione remains in custody in Pennsylvania as he fights extradition to New York. He's hired the prominent lawyer Karen Friedman Agnifilo to represent him. She is the former second-in-command of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. A defense fund for Luigi Mangione has already raised over $100,000 in the latest sign that he's become a folk hero to some. On Sunday, Senator Bernie Sanders appeared on Meet the Press and talked about why there is so much anger directed at the health insurance industry.
What you have seen rising up is people's anger at a health insurance industry which denies people the health care that they desperately need while they make billions and billions of dollars in profit. So killing anybody, shooting somebody in the back who's the father of two, is outrageous. It is unacceptable. Nobody should applaud it. I know Senator Warren did not. Mm-hmm. But I think what we need to ask ourselves when we talk about health care is why we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people, why we have a life expectancy which is significantly lower than in other countries, why working class people die 5 to 10 years shorter than the people on top.
We're joined now by the investigative journalist Ken Klippenstein. He's broken several stories on the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. He was the first to publish Luigi Mangione's full manifesto. He also obtained leaked internal documents detailing UnitedHealthcare PR campaign in response to the shooting. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Ken. When we say that you were the first to publish the manifesto, you weren't the first to get your hands on the manifesto. In fact, most media had their hands on it. Explain how you made that decision to publish it when they were withholding it.
That's exactly right. The news media, major media outlets from the New York Times to the Post, CNN, ABC, all had their hands on this document, were sitting on it, sharing it with themselves socially, which I know from my friends at these various outlets, but refused to provide it to the general public. And so when I obtained the document and read through it. I didn't see any reason not to publish it. And so I went ahead, did that in response to what I saw as media paternalism at its worst. The judgment that this is safe for us to read, but it's not okay for the public to read.
Ken, in that manifesto, what do you think were some key portions that were most newsworthy that the public deserved to know about?
The overwhelming focus on the healthcare system as an institution. That's not, of course, to say that it's okay to kill somebody. I think that goes almost without saying to advance those goals. But to see in this the fact that it wasn't just a completely random act of violence, as in fact the major media repeatedly asserted it was. If you look at, there's one particularly egregious case by CNN in how they were trying to paraphrase the contents of the document, again, without providing the underlying document to the public to come to their own conclusions, saying that in this are the rantings and ravings of a crazy person. When you read through that document, which wasn't that long, but it's very clear from it that this individual was motivated by grievances about the healthcare system. And so that's why it's important to get that out to the public. I think that if you ask these major media outlets why they didn't do that, the explanations fall along roughly two lines. One is that it's not safe for the public to have this. It might inspire copycat killings. I think that's similar to saying, you know, violent video games are going to cause children to shoot up schools. I'm very skeptical of that. But in addition to that, what I found in the course of my reporting on that document was that there were deals that were struck with law enforcement, which furnished this document to various media outlets, in which they were essentially blackmailed into not releasing these records because they didn't want to alienate the sources that they depended on for not just this document, but other exclusives.
You also looked at how United Healthcare responded to the dam breaking on the immense anger directed at the healthcare industry after the killing of Brian Thompson. You've said the media is largely tone deaf. If you can go over the second information that you received, which was the internal documents of United Healthcare responding to this assassination and to the anger in particular at the healthcare industry that it unleashed.
Yeah, over the course of reporting on this story, I've interviewed probably a dozen United Healthcare employees who themselves were shocked and horrified at how out of touch not just the public-facing response, but the internal messaging to employees about this was. Something I didn't realize was the extent to which people working in these call centers, right up to management, not just, you know, low-level grunts, themselves are upset about having to deny claims and the way in which the industry conducts itself. And they felt as though, this was something I heard repeatedly in my interviews with them, to not acknowledge that as at least a part of this story is to overlook and to misunderstand what this is all about. And so they're getting their own internal messaging saying, you know, everything's fine. Much of this changed around Thursday or Friday when the New York Times chose to publish an op-ed by the CEO of UnitedHealthcare's parent company, United Health Group, CEO by the name of Andrew Witty. And it was only at that point, just a few days ago, that the tone sort of shifted towards I feel your pain, I understand that healthcare is far from perfect. But prior to that, there was very little in the way of recognition and acknowledgement of the public's anger, not just on the part of United Healthcare, but on the part of the news media as well.
And let's talk a little about how the other aspects that the corporate media has missed in this story. You delved into the legal problems facing United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson before he was killed. Talk about the Hollywood Firefighters Pension Fund and the lawsuit that they had going.
Yeah, so in May, the Hollywood Firefighters Pension Fund filed a lawsuit against United Healthcare, the deceased United Healthcare CEO, alleging that he had engaged in insider trading and fraud in relation to a Justice Department investigation that was recently launched into the company for allegedly anti-competitive practices, which the then CEO, Brian Thompson, was aware of, had knowledge of, and did not disclose to either the public or investors, and ended up selling, I think, over $10 million of his own private, personally held stock in the company before disclosing that to the public, which has the effect of benefiting him, but hurting the rest of the shareholders which aren't just, you know, rich investors. That's also pension funds and retirement funds who don't have the benefit of that knowledge to make decisions on.
And Ken Klippenstein, if you can talk about all that has happened since the killing of Brian Thompson, the response with wanted online posters of other CEOs in New York, those posters appearing, and your response to what that means. And then in the corporate media, while they've been forced, because there's such a tremendous backlash against the health insurance industry now to address what's happening, there is little discussion, and certainly United Healthcare is not talking about it, of universal health care.
That's exactly right. And I speculate that it is the absence of discourse around our health care system that fed into the rage we're seeing now. I did a story during the election on the two conventions for the major nominees, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, and noticed that between the two of them, in their convention speeches, they mentioned the word healthcare twice. So for the first time in my adult life, going back to Obama, going back to the 2016 elections where Senator Bernie Sanders put healthcare front and center at that election, and then most recently in 2020, when Biden even gave a nod to the public option, this is the first election in my adult memory that I can recall healthcare not being at the center of the debate. And when you do something like that, it doesn't surprise me that the public is angry, not just at the silence on the part of politicians, but the sense that things are not going to change. And to miss that as part of this story is just malpractice, because that is the backdrop against which this entire event took place, and I think is informing a lot of the frustration and rage that people have, not necessarily at the CEO as an individual, but the CEO as a personification of the healthcare system that people feel this episode represents.
And Ken, you've also noted that within the healthcare industry, the employees, for instance, of United Health have deep concerns as well about how the company is functioning in regards to the people it insures. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to people who describe hanging up with people trying to get claims filled, sobbing at the sense of sadness and empathy for the situation in which they are, and you know, they're just having to base their decisions off of a structured list of rules that are decided on high that they have no say in, and that was the biggest shock to me in reporting on this, was realizing how little daylight there is between many of the employees that I talked to and the general frustration you're hearing from the rest of the public. If you read the New York Times and Washington Post, they'll tell you they've repeatedly run stories saying, oh, you know, employees are feel as though they're being, you know, treated unfairly by the public opinion. It's not really health insurance companies' fault. It's, you know, maybe hospitals and doctors, that kind of thing. Certainly the dozen or so people that I've talked to, I'm able to identify very little in the way of disagreement that they have with some of the most angry sentiments we're seeing expressed on the part of the general public.
Finally, Ken, the MAGA right lionizing, this is going back in time, Kyle Rittenhouse, who, when he was 17, fatally shot two men and injured one with a semi-automatic rifle during racial justice protests in Kenosha in Wisconsin, where the state you're in right now in 2020, becomes a cause célèbre among U.S. conservatives during the trial, continues to be lionized by gun supporters, among others. Your response to those who say the left is doing the same with Mangione now, and that no matter what the cause, the extrajudicial assassination of anyone is reprehensible, Ken?
Yes, of course it is. I think that practically, I hope that goes without saying. As to the political dimensions to this, I would encourage people to just look at the manifesto, look at the wealth of social media posts that are available to us to go through and read and get a sense of the alleged shooter's political ideology. And I think what will become clear is that this is not a partisan issue, just as healthcare being a serious problem in this country is not a partisan issue. I think that comes through very clearly in both the manifesto that I published and in the public response, too. I mean, this is anecdotal, but even just on a personal level, the people that I've heard express frustration in the wake of this, they're not saying, oh, you know, this is all you know, Obama's fault or Biden's fault or Trump's fault. They are angry at the corporations, which, in the case of UnitedHealthcare, spend huge sums of money lobbying the federal government on both sides. And you can see this in their campaign, in their political contribution disclosures, lobbying both parties to keep the system that we have in place and to make sure that the problems we have are not ameliorated.
Ken Klippenstein, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Investigative reporter, have broken a number of stories on UnitedHealthcare CEO killing. We'll link to your recent articles posted at KenKlippenstein.com. Speaking to us from Madison, Wisconsin, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we end today's show with a look more closely at UnitedHealth's policies. ProPublica has just published an expose looking at how UnitedHealth is aggressively trying to limit treatment for thousands of children with autism in an effort to cut costs. The ProPublica report is based on leaked documents from inside the company. Last month, ProPublica exposed how UnitedHealth is limiting health, mental health coverage for many in another cost-saving measure.
We're joined now by Annie Waldman, an award-winning reporter at ProPublica who broke both of these stories. Annie, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out what you found.
Yeah, so this year, my colleagues and I have been investigating how insurance companies interfere with mental health care. And we have spoken with hundreds of providers, patients from all across the country, and they have described to us many challenges that they've had with insurance companies. But one company in particular has stood out, and this is even before the events of the past few weeks, and that is UnitedHealth Group, as well as UnitedHealthcare, its insurance company, as well as its division Optum, which manages its mental health benefits. And over the course of our reporting, we have obtained leaked documents, which are effectively the company's internal playbook for limiting mental health care. And in these documents, we have uncovered that the company has engaged in a secret internal cost-cutting strategy that is essentially trying to limit the care of children with autism all across the country.
And how precisely do they do this?
So the internal documents show that there is a specialized therapy for children with autism that the company calls, and these are the company's words, the gold standard treatment. They say it's evidence-based. And over the past few years, there has been an increase in the number of children diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. Because of this increase, it's put a lot of pressure on the company's bottom line. And so they have developed market plans, special action plans to essentially limit access to this care. They are doing it in two ways. First, they are trying to limit access to the therapy itself by pushing providers out of the network. They are preventing new providers of this specific therapy from joining their insurance networks, and they are terminating the contracts of providers who are already in their network, citing cost outliers as one of the reasons for that. And this can be very detrimental to families who, you know, this therapy is incredibly expensive. It's very hard to pay for it out of pocket. And so if their provider is kicked out of their insurance network, their children may not have access to this care. The other thing that they're doing is they're engaging in a rigorous utilization management review system, which essentially means that they are targeting providers, calling them up on the phone, and then questioning them about the medical necessity of the treatment. This can lead to denials of coverage for many families.
So let's make this real with the example of a story. Tell us the story of Sherelle Menard and her son Benji, diagnosed when he was 3 years old with autism.
That's right. So over the past couple of months, I've been trying to understand, you know, what are the real human stories behind these documents? It can look like jargon, very dry on the page. But then when you speak to families, you really realize how this impacts them. I've spent a number of, over the past few months, spent some time with Sherelle Menard and her son Benji. He's 10 years old. He's severely affected by autism. He only speaks a few dozen words. They're based in Lafayette, Louisiana, here in Louisiana, where I'm based. And, you know, what has happened is that Benji has had increased behavioral challenges over the past year. His clinical team has decided that they want to increase the number of hours of his therapy. So they went to his insurer, which is UnitedHealthcare by way of Medicaid, and they asked to increase the number of hours of coverage of that he is in therapy. But they were denied. And essentially what the company said was that Benji had been in this specific therapy for too long, and they did not believe that he was going to make enough progress to essentially be able to leave this therapy. You know, experts, we showed the denial to many experts and advocates who said this was outrageous, that, you know, this type of therapy can be used for the maintenance of, you know, or prevention of deterioration, or just to help kids maintain the progress that they've already had. And so Sherelle Menard now has to go to an official administrative law review in order to try to get this denial overturned. She's doing that next month in January.
And how might United Healthcare's strategy be violating a federal law?
Yeah, so most people don't realize this, but there's actually a federal law that protects mental and behavioral health benefits. It's called the Mental Health Parity Act. It was passed in 2008. And essentially what it means is that insurance companies cannot limit your access to mental health care. They essentially have to provide similar access to physical health care as they do for mental health care. And so if this company is using similar strategies to limit physical health care, perhaps it's kosher. But, you know, the experts and the advocates that we've spoken to have said that this strategy is legally questionable. On top of that, it appears that the company is actually targeting Medicaid plans, so the most vulnerable and the poorest families amongst us, with this strategy. And so this strategy may actually, according to the advocates we've spoken with, it might violate Medicaid laws as well, which require prompt access to medically necessary care for children.
And when you say that they are targeting Medicaid plans, are they managing Medicaid plans like they do with Medicare Advantage?
That's correct. United actually manages Medicaid plans in 24 states and for about 6 million people, including 10,000 children with autism spectrum disorder. And so how these Medicaid managed care plans tend or typically operate is that the company receives a specific fixed amount of money for a patient, regardless of how many services they use or the intensity of those services. And if there's money left over, the company, which are typically these private insurers, are allowed to keep what's left over. You know, federal investigators as well as experts have said that there might be an incentive that's put in place that they might try to deny care in order to pocket the additional sum. So there have been questions about whether this is the most appropriate setup, particularly for Medicaid plans or any other type of public funding for healthcare.
Annie, we only have a minute, but you write about United's algorithm program saying, quote, called ALERT. The algorithmic system was created years earlier to identify patients at risk of suicide or substance abuse. The company redeployed it to identify therapy overuse. Can you elaborate on this as we wrap up?
Yeah, so we spoke with hundreds of providers, as I mentioned, and many of them told us about this mystery. They were getting flagged by the insurance company for these aggressive reviews where they would be questioned about the medical necessity of their therapy for their patients, and potentially that therapy could be cut off. What we found out was actually the company had been investigated in three different states and by the Department of Labor for these practices, and they were told that it was illegal and they had to stop it in these jurisdictions. However, the way that our regulation of health insurance works in this country is that it really depends on the jurisdiction in which these actions take place. So even though United Healthcare was told that it was doing something illegal in three different states, it could actually continue to operate with this strategy in other states unless those states took the enforcement. And so what we found is that the company, in effect, rebranded this system, and they're using similar practices around the country to essentially question and potentially cut off care.
Annie Waldman, there's so much to cover here. We're going to link to your reports. Annie's speaking to us from New Orleans in Louisiana. She's a reporter at ProPublica covering healthcare. We'll link to your articles. United Health is strategically limiting access to critical treatment for kids with autism, as well as how United Health's playbook for limiting mental health coverage puts countless Americans' treatment at risk. That does it for our show. Happy birthday, Renee Feltz. I'm Amy Goodman, sitting right next to Juan Gonzalez here in New York.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Mm-hmm.